The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, so first up, David, we have a story about why the Bering Strait land bridge did more in our past than just let people go from continent to continent.
Right. Well, Sarah, for those out there who don't know this, the Bering Strait land bridge was this strip of land that connected what is modern day Siberia to Alaska. And not only did animals seem to have crossed it tens of thousands of years ago, but human beings may have too. In fact, some of the earliest settlers in North America may have arrived via the land bridge. Well, this news today says the land bridge also may have had another very important impact. It may have caused very violent and random temperature swings about 80,000 years ago.
So how can the land bridge's existence have caused these changes in temperature?
Well, that's the sort of the question that the researchers are trying to figure out. What they do know is that starting about 80,000 years ago, every decade or so, the temperature rose or fell by 10 degrees Celsius, which is a lot. And this happened for 70,000 years. So you had this really long period of time where the temperature was just going up and down all the time. I mean, imagine on Earth the temperature going up and down 10 degrees every decade. It's really crazy. Researchers didn't originally think the land bridge had anything to do with it. They thought, well, maybe there was some sort of variation in the sun's activity, or there was some other sort of unstable climatic process going on. Researchers ran some climate simulations. And what they did was, they ran some simulations in which the Bering Strait is what they call open, which means it's sort of like it is today. There's no land bridge there. The North Pacific and the Arctic Ocean basically flow right into each other. And in the other simulation, the Bering Strait was closed, meaning there was this broad land bridge that was separating these two oceans. And then what they did was they virtually added a large amount of fresh water to the North Atlantic. And the reason they did this is because at the time, tens of thousands of years ago, fresh water was actually entering these oceans because ice sheets were melting during this time, especially during warm spells.
So they added this fresh water to the ocean, and what difference did whether the land bridge was there or not make?
What they saw was that in both simulations, both when the Bering Strait was open and closed, the surface waters became really, really fresh. In fact, they became so fresh with this fresh water, then the upper layer never really got denser than the underlying salty water and therefore never sank. And when this happens, it actually shuts down ocean circulation and plunges areas around the North Atlantic, including Greenland, into a cold spell. And that happened in both simulations. But there was one critical difference between the two simulations. When the Bering Strait was closed, it took about 1,400 years for ocean circulation to recover, versus when it was open, the recirculation recovered just in about 400 years or less. And that's a sign that ocean circulation is stable when the strait is open. Because of a stable ocean circulation, you don't have these sort of dramatic rises and fall in temperature as you would have when the land bridge is there and ocean circulation is far less stable.
Well, so are we going to see any effect like this with global climate change?
Well, because of global climate change, actually, the sea level is going to continue to rise, which means that this Bering land bridge is going to be even under more water than it was before, which means the Bering Strait is going to be even more open, if that's possible, than it was before. So you shouldn't be looking forward to any violent swings in temperature anytime soon.
At least not caused by this.
Not caused by this, exactly.
So next up, we have a story that suggests where humans might have gotten their giant brains.
Right. Sarah, our brains, at least the average adult brain, weighs about 1.3 kilograms. It's got 100 billion neurons, and it sucks up 20% of the oxygen we breathe. This is a very needy organ, and it's not one that we actually need, or at least one that an animal our size needs. Our brains, compared to the size of our body, are bigger than that of any other animal on the planet. And the question is, for a long time, why do we have such big brains? One of the going hypotheses is it's because we need it to be social. You can think to your relationships with your friends, or you can think about Facebook, or you can think about whatever you want, but we have very complicated relationships with each other. We've got to keep track of who's our friend, who's our enemy, where we're ranking on the social ladder. All these things take a lot of computational power. And the idea has been that's the reason we have big brains. And researchers have actually seen correlations like that, not only in us, but in primates that are closely related to us, other creatures with big brains like dolphins. seem to live in very social societies. So this seems to support the hypothesis that for some reason we need big brains to be social.
So what's the new evidence that the story is about?
All this stuff that I just talked about is just a correlation. It doesn't actually show how our brains could have grown just by being social. So this study involves another computer simulation, but they're not simulating ocean currents here. They're actually simulating the growth of virtual brains. They started with 50 simple brains, and these are very simple brains. They actually just had 3 to 6 neurons each. Mm-hmm. And then they made these little brains play 2 classic games with each other. The object of both of these games are to sort of cooperate with your partner. And if you cooperate in the long run, you're more likely to do better at these games than if you don't cooperate.
And so what happened with the brains that did a better job cooperating?
So the brains that did a better job cooperating, these brains got to reproduce over and over, over, I think, 50,000 generations. And they also were subject to some random mutations that made them potentially bigger or smaller or more complex or less complex. And what the researchers found was that after 50,000 generations, the brains that were the best at cooperating were also the largest, kind of like what we see in ourselves and some of these other complicated animals. So this gives a potential sort of path, an evolutionary path, to how this all happened, that the idea is that as we evolved and became sort of a more cooperative society, our brains were also growing along with us.
Really interesting. Last up, we have a story about how shaking your head at a party might mean that you are listening or you're not listening.
This story is about something called the cocktail party problem. And if you've ever been in a noisy room or a loud bar and somebody's trying to talk to you, you know, for maybe the first couple seconds, it's kind of difficult because you've got people talking in the background, maybe glasses are clinking in the background, maybe music's playing, whatever. And you've got to separate out what your friend is saying to you from all the other noise in the room. And that's the researchers call that the cocktail party problem. This study is trying to figure out how our brain sort of resets itself, for lack of a better word, during this problem. Because after a couple seconds, we do hone in on that conversation. But there are things we can do, apparently, that sort of disrupt things again. And all of a sudden, we've got all these noises coming at us at once. We have a hard time filtering. And then we've got to sort of hone in on a conversation again.
So they used robots for this experiment,
yes,
which I was really surprised by.
Yes. You can actually see a video of what this robot looks like. It's actually kind of creepy. It's a humanoid robot. And the reason they use the robots is because they wanted to figure out, you know, when people were listening to a very complicated sound. And here's a sound that sounds something like the sound they used in the study. And you can see that there's actually a couple things going on in that sound. It's not just sort of one continuous noise. It's sort of a couple different things. And that's, you know, a very simplified version of the cocktail party problem where there's multiple signals coming in. You've got to separate one from the other. But it turns out when researchers want to see, you know, how we reset these noises in our brain, the head movements we make that we might sort of, as you said at the outset, sort of cock our head or make some funny head movements, it's really hard to track that stuff. The robot was sort of wired in such a way that it was moving its head in time with the way the person did. When they looked at the robot, they saw that a rapid head motion, maybe a rapid cock of the head or a turn of the head, actually disrupts this honing ability that we have, this ability to sort of separate out one sound from all of the other sounds or one sound from all of the background noise.
So shaking your head does clear out your ears.
Well, it kind of has the opposite effect because you're talking to somebody and you know, you're in a loud room and say I'm talking to you. I can hear what you're saying because I filtered your sound out from all the other sounds. But then I shake my head and actually all those sounds come rushing back to me again. So I've sort of reset it, which is actually kind of bad. It sort of says, you know, if you are paying attention to somebody in a crowded room, you shouldn't do a lot of rapid head motions because for at least a couple of seconds, you're going to lose that ability to really hone in on what that person is saying.
So one question that gets addressed at the end of the story is that a bug or a feature?
Right. It seems like a bug because it seems like, you know, we just talked about how complicated our brains are. You know, we should be able to move around a lot and not sort of lose the train of conversation or at least lose the honing ability that we've developed. But it's some sort of, you know, call it a bug, call it something else. But it seems that, you know, we're able to disrupt this very complicated ability by something as simple as shaking our head.
All right. So what else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about a group of college students solving a pothole problem with something called non-Newtonian fluids. We've also got a story about reading in baboons. And for Science Insider, our science policy blog, we've got a story about a dubious record that a researcher has just achieved. The most retractions for any single researcher in history, it appears. We've also got a story about a new bill in Tennessee that would allow teachers to challenge the teaching of evolution. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the science of decision making. Why do we make the decisions we do, and what impact does it have on everything from buying cereal to voting in elections? And next week's Science Live is about human-triggered earthquakes. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
I will. Thanks, David.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.